The Guardian.
Welcome to The Future of Journalism, a series of seminars and discussions organised by The Guardian exploring the transition of the media. Kicking off the series is Jonathan Zittrain, Professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the University of Oxford. He's recently published a book called The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. In this Guardian talk, Zittrain takes the question, what is the future of journalism? And explains that whatever direction journalists take, the influence and culture of the internet will play a deciding role.
What I want to talk about today and just get us talking about are a few thoughts about the future of the internet. These are the thoughts reflected in my recent research and in the book, which you can download for free online, but I'd prefer that you buy the book. And tie it to some thoughts about the future of journalism, those thoughts offered by an outsider, ready for the piranhas in the room to nibble away gracefully at it as I offer it up. And I actually think there's a real connection between the two. And as I think about it, I look at some of the history of the net and try to think what were the key moments or the signal moments that help us to understand the trajectory we've been on. This is one of them. This is Steve Jobs at the 1977 West Coast Computer Fair introducing to the world for the first time the Apple II personal computer. And in fact, for the first time, you had in a single plastic molded case a reprogrammable box accessible to anybody. You could spend a few hundred bucks, get one of these things, bring it home, and get a blinking cursor and wonder what to do next. And then you would tinker around with it. Maybe you would do anybody in the 10 print high, 20 go to the 10 camp. Yeah, all right, a few people. Those were good times. And then you'd be like, still, what's this really for? And it's interesting to think that at the time Jobs put it out, he wasn't sure he had an answer to what's this really for. It's like, I don't know, why climb Everest? You know, it's like, get the blinking cursor, see what you can do. And Apple didn't have firmly held views. Fortunately, they weren't limited to their own vision of what the thing could do. And that's why within 2 years, two guys, Bob Frankston and Dan Bricklin, had invented VisiCalc, the first computer spreadsheet ever. And businesses around the world were like, holy mother of, you know, we've been waiting for you for years. And to run the spreadsheet, you needed the Apple. Apples start flying off the shelves, and Apple Computer has no idea why. They have to do market research to figure out why their box is so popular. And that's a great example of what I call generative technologies that are valuable platforms open to outside contribution and unfiltered outside contribution. So it's not like Steve Jobs has much to say about what you do with his box that will generally surprise us, with the spreadsheet being quite a nice surprise. In 1977, Steve Jobs wasn't the only one making mischief. This, of course, is Bill Gates, pictured at his traffic stop in Albuquerque, New Mexico, smiling from ear to ear, showing that he will buy and sell us all someday. I like that his sense of fashion has not changed significantly in 30 years. And when I think of this mugshot, I think of the fact that, in a way, a driver of the consumer information technology space for the past 30 years has been this kind of character, a young, smiley, asocial, poorly dressed, brilliant nerd. That's the dark energy of the space, with dark energy being the force that keeps the universe expanding faster, increasingly, than it should. And so this phenomenon is being powered by something called dark energy, although a cosmologist confided in me that the only reason they call it energy is so they get funding from the Department of Energy in the U.S., which has worked beautifully. But they otherwise don't understand it. And I think similarly here, this force is underappreciated. The ways in which people, not always working to have a business plan, to have partnerships and such, are driving the advances that we see. This box, which is what Gates and Jobs gave us, has not changed significantly in its architecture in the past 30 years. This is a model from 1992. Does anybody from the Print Hello Go to 10 audience tell us how we know the date of the thing?
The BIOS.
It's in the BIOS, but how do we know from the picture? Yes, the 66 light. With a button next to it, if you press it, it goes into turbo mode, and Prince of Persia runs twice as fast. And, of course, that means the hamsters inside are running twice as fast on their wheels. And I'm pleased to say, actually, that they now have a hamster-powered paper shredder. And you put the paper in the top, the hamster runs on the wheel here, and then can live in the shredded paper afterwards. So it just shows you that reuse is a viable alternative to recycling. and I've now satisfied the green component of the speech, now mandated by the United Nations. So these boxes, whether from 77, from 92, from 2007, will run any code you give it. And the maker of the box, the platform, has nothing to say about it, which single-handedly created the entire off-the-shelf software market and created the non-market in shareware and freeware. People can just decide to give stuff away, and you never know who will give what away next. A guy named Peter Tatum at the University of Tasmania Psychology Department tinkers around and creates Trumpet Windsock, the little widget that would take a Windows 3.1 machine and allow it to use the internet. It was like Microsoft was too busy to make that little widget. So Peter Tatum, you know, huge numbers of copies of Trumpet Windsock going out because a guy in Tasmania thought it might be an interesting idea. Compare that with the technologies that came before, such as the IBM System 360. This is a blinking cursor machine, too. It's utterly reprogrammable. But from its construction, you can see it screams, "Don't come near me." Right? This is only for experts. You will die if you try to use me and you are not an expert. And that was the business model attached to these machines. Generally, you would contract with somebody like IBM for a solution. This might be in the basement of your building, but it's IBM people in white lab coats that would be using it, or only very specially trained personnel doing only approved tasks to solve a discrete problem identified as the reason to buy the machine to begin with. And in that sense, I say this effectively was not a generative technology. Another non-generative technology, but still useful, is the Friedan Flexer writer. This is a little typewriter where you would type here, and then as you typed, you could have indentations appear in this tape, and then you could thread the tape back through, and like a player piano, it would type whatever was on the tape. And with scissors and glue, you could cut and paste your way to a mail merge more easily than you can with Microsoft Word. It's a very useful device, but not reprogrammable. So even though you can get near it and there aren't men in lab coats preventing you from using it, it's not meant to be reprogrammable, no blinking cursor, just an appliance. And that had its own descendants as well, such as the Brother Smart Word Processor of the 1980s. Some of you may remember writing for the school paper or doing term papers on one of these things. You turn it on, there's the main menu, provided by Brother, designed to be satisfying to you so that you have reason to shell out money for one, but it anticipates that it knows what you would want to do with it before you bring it home. And what you see is the way it will be for months or years after you obtain it. When you throw it away, that's still the main menu of the thing. Notice they ripped off the spreadsheet from the Apple II by the time this particular model had been off the line. Now, there's a similar comparison to be made between generative and non-generative or sterile technologies in the network space. What we were just talking about was the endpoint, the hardware space. These are three of the founders of the internet. They were classmates at the same high school in Los Angeles together in the 1960s. We had like the French Club or the Debate Club. They had a Let's Build a Global Network Club, and it worked very well. And they're pictured here for their 25th anniversary photo showing that you can build a network out of just about anything. Their network doesn't work. It goes ear to ear and mouth to mouth, which I hope is an inside joke rather than that the framers of the internet don't know how to string tin cans together. And the network that they designed in their backwater reflects one huge constraint and one huge absence of constraint, each of which are notable. The constraint is they had no money. So they designed a network that was designed to cobble together existing networks. So you start here. If you're in Utah, you can just connect to this guy, and you're as good as on the internet. It doesn't matter where you plug in as long as you just plug in to somebody already on the net. They designed routing protocols so that I could take this laser pointer, hand it to Catherine, Catherine hands it back, it goes all the way back one person at a time so that it gets to the person at the end of the room who's been designated to receive it, and we are the network. We don't actually have somebody like FedEx come in and move it from one part of the room to another. It all relies on faith that people in the middle will pass a laser pointer on behalf of someone they don't know, have never met, and are not in contractual privity with, for the sake of somebody on the other end whom they don't know, have never met, and are not in contractual privity with. Why? Because it's just a neighborly thing to do. Okay, this is an insane way to build a network. This is called best efforts routing, or send it and pray. Also called every packet an adventure. And it's represented here in this hourglass architecture because so long as the packets move, that's internet protocol in the middle, they don't care what hardware they're moving over. That's the bring your own network part of things. They don't care what application you're using with it. You're doing email, you're surfing the web, there's some new thing invented called BitTorrent, whatever. Our job is just to move the packets. That's the absence of constraint because they don't have to make any money. And if they don't have to make any money It means they don't need a business plan. It means they don't have to know how many users they have or how long the user's been online because they're not trying to charge them for anything. They're just suggesting, here's how we could all have a network if we wanted to be happy, which is a very weird way to build a network. Again, it's why as late as 1992, IBM is fond of saying you couldn't possibly build a corporate network using Internet Protocol. And that's why the people who framed the network say that their mascot, if they had one, would be the bumblebee, because the fur to wingspan ratio has for far too long been too heavy for the bee to actually fly, and yet somehow the bee flies. I'm pleased to say that they have finally figured out how bees fly. They flap their wings. So compare that generative, bizarre network with the standard network that many of us thought we would be inheriting in the early 1990s, late 1980s, a network like CompuServe or AOL or Prodigy or The Source or Minitel, a network where there's a main menu and it looks pretty much like the Brother Smart Word Processor, each button provided by CompuServe. You click on the button. They're trying to satisfy you. They want you to pay connect time by the hour, but because they have to charge you and because it's their network, they're already in the business of trying to cultivate relationships that lead to content that is high quality. And interestingly, this plan resulted in far less and less compelling content than the internet plan, which had no main menu, no plan for content, no investment in content, just a suggestion that if people had content and there were people who wanted to see it, why, let's put them together. Totally crazy as a way of beating out those proprietary and sterile alternatives. So you put the generative internet together with the generative PC, and you end up getting this explosion in the late 1990s of pretty amazing stuff coming from corners that are not incumbents. They are not powerful. They don't have a ton of money or political connections. They just do something, and amidst all the bees that shouldn't fly and don't, there are a few that shouldn't fly and do. So one example would be the Swede and the Estonian who sit down together and create Skype. Their first project was Kazaa, actually, peer-to-peer file sharing. After bringing the music industry to its knees, they're like, what should we do next? They're like, all right, let's do Skype. Let's bring the telecommunications industry to its knees. And when they were done with Skype, they were like, let's do Juiced. We're going to bring the television industry to its knees. Sometimes I think if the content people were just to knock off these two guys, it would be in much better shape. eBay, online auction, started by a guy named Pierre, I mean, kind of out of left field. Sotheby's, Christie's, where were the incumbents? They weren't really thinking about it. But you have a couple people out of left field, they can set it up and see where it goes. Or Wikipedia, great example. A guy named Jimbo comes up to you in 2001. It's like, I got a great idea. We start off with 7 articles, and then anybody can edit anything at any time, and then we'll get an encyclopedia. The answer to that is, you're nuts. Right? Stupidest idea in the history of the world. And yet somehow the bee flies. In fact, it's such a stupid idea that Jimbo, the founder of Wikipedia, can actually honestly say he never had it. The point of the wiki in Wikipedia was just as a kind of backstage corral where people could muck around to improve articles for an encyclopedia project called Newpedia, which was much more orthodox, regular encyclopedia. And then it just took off. It surprised even its founder. You didn't have to conceive of how stupid an idea it was until it turned out to be a good one, and only in retrospect were you like, what? Wikipedia works in practice, but not in theory. And it is now so ubiquitous that it can be found in Chinese restaurant menus. This is actually a real photo of a real Chinese restaurant menu. You can get your stir-fried Wikipedia regular or with pimentos. I have a theory as to how this happened, but I'll save that for any question and answer we may have. So I say you have generativity down here with the boxes that beat out the Flexer writers and the other IBM System 360 approach to doing things. You have generativity here at the logical layer with things like Internet Protocol and the network. That then allows crazy people like Jimbo to come up with ideas that they didn't really come up with for something like Wikipedia at the content layer, where Wikipedia is generative because people who aren't nerds can edit articles contributing from awkward and unaccredited corners to create new content. That's a great example of generativity at the content layer, running on code that was developed down here. And finally, you can even have generativity at the social layer. I don't know how many people have heard of Twitter, probably a lot. You know, when I first thought of Twitter, I was like, my God, something more inane than a blog. I didn't think it was possible. Like, wow, those long blog entries suddenly seem so deep and thoughtful next to 120 characters. It's like, what's coming after Twitter? Like, just type the letter indicating how you feel. But then you get a guy like James Buck. He goes to Cairo. He's covering unrest there. He gets arrested and he tweets it. And 520 people are instantly notified that the guy's been arrested, and the calls start pouring in to the Egyptian Foreign Ministry, to the British Foreign Ministry, to the U.S. State Department, and the guy gets sprung thanks to the fact that he got his tweet out as stuff was happening. Or couchsurfing.com. How many people are familiar with couchsurfing.com? Any couch surfers? A couple. Our blogger, Sarah, you used it? Have you used it?
I haven't used it, no.
Has anybody actually used it? Couchsurfing puts together, it creates the market at last, pairing up people who are traveling to a strange city and would like to stay on a stranger's couch for free with people who live in strange cities and want a stranger to sleep on their couch and not pay them anything. It's like, who knew, right? And yet, there's a ton of people doing couchsurfing. This is actually an old screen snapshot. There's now over 300,000 that say they have tried it in one way or another, and more people are like, yeah, it's no big deal. It's a lot of fun. It's great. Now, what's probably going through the mind of somebody who's never heard of couchsurfing is how many people have been killed using couchsurfing.com? And I'm glad you asked. There don't appear to be any, but I realize it's a self-selected group who leave feedback after the event, so I guess that's not totally probative. But my sense is that this is waiting for a tipping point where the crooks discover it, and short of killing somebody, they use it to, you know, boost everything out of the house on a couch surfing expedition, at which point there's a crisis for this instrumentality. And in fact, I see this kind of crisis arising out of generative platforms precisely when and because they get popular. And they bring in people who don't share the ethos, who aren't as intertwined with the details, who just show up expecting a free place to stay. Not in the attitude of couch surfing, where you're supposed to play the harp or do the dishes or something. You know, it's meant to be like a social phenomenon. They're just like, it's a bed and breakfast and it costs nothing. It's like a coupon. And then you end up, even short of stealing things or hurting people, you end up with the thing starting to sputter. I think of this at the content layer, like the phenomenon of blogs. As recently as 2005, it made sense for Business Week to run a cover story that's like, blogs will change your business. You haven't heard of them, but they're a really big deal. And why? Because like most generative things, they start in a backwater. It's just people with mild OCD who do it, and they're doing it about their cats, and it just doesn't seem significant. I do have to tell you my favorite cat-oriented blog. It's catsthatlooklikehitler.com. Very generative. People can submit photos of their cats if they look like Hitler. And these are some of the top Kittlers. I gotta say, imagine coming home to that cat every day. It's like, holy cow. It has not yet spawned spin-off sites like catsthatlooklikegerbils.com, but this really seems to be the sweet spot. But then it starts to get serious, and you get things, and full disclosure, I've been part of this project called Global Voices that ask and offer the opportunity for people around the world to blog without having to be nerds from their countries using cheap instrumentalities. And then it turns out when something happens in Burma or Kenya or Algeria, you get people blogging and the mainstream media actually can turn to them, see a bit of a history that this person didn't just show up to offer the perfect news whispered in the ear, but to see there are people there who've been in their own way reporting firsthand what's going on in their respective homelands. Now, just as it gets that popular, there is reason, as I say, to subvert it. Just like couch surfing, so too for blogs. So these are some of the comments pending on my own modest blog at the Oxford Internet Institute. My blog is not about pharmaceuticals, but you wouldn't know it from the comments because a robot comes in and just leaves one comment after another pointing back to its cheap illegal pharmaceutical site, hoping that when then Google looks through the comments at my blog to make its own search index, it will see lots of pointers and think, wow, these sites are really popular because it's all the buzz in the blogosphere. This is pretty evil. So the internet fights back generatively. We create the CAPTCHA. This is actually pretty new. but now it feels like we've had it forever. It's the squishy green word that a computer can create, for which when you type in that word, you prove that you're a human, because it's hard for computers to read the squishy greenness of it, even though it's easy for the computer to create it. So I put this in my blog, and I say, if you're going to leave a comment, at least be a human. That works for a while. And then the spammers fight back. The first thing they do is they use a generative internet to set up CAPTCHA sweatshops. So people on the net can just sit and solve CAPTCHAs all day in the privacy of their own homes, earn $2.50 an hour, and as they're solving the CAPTCHAs, somewhere in the world a spammy comment is being left on a blog. Now, this still costs something to the spammers, so they've gotten more creative. They've set up websites and software containing free pornography. And it really is free pornography. There is exactly one catch to it. In order to see each picture, you have to type the image, the word that you see in the image. Where do they get the image with the word? From my site, where they want to leave the spammy comment. They take the image, they put it there. The person who wants the porn types what he sees. He gets to see then the picture. The answer goes, plugs in here. They get to leave the spammy comment, and everybody's happy. If there were a Nobel Prize for evil, this would be like an evil genius subcategory runner-up. And exactly that kind of subversion is taking place not just social layer, content layer, but down back into the protocol and hardware layers that I was talking about. On our machines today, that glorious .exe that I was celebrating with pay-ins to Peter Tatum in Tasmania, that's the characteristic that means I actually have no idea what my computer is doing right now. I think it's doing a PowerPoint presentation, but these things can multitask. This is a nice fast processor, and it's on your internet because I just found a hole in the floor and put an Ethernet cable in, and internet came spewing out. So it might be sending spam right now. One of these executables on the machine might be the executable that's the Trojan horse, that's the zombie directing this machine to attack other machines and showing that the Guardian isn't getting along well with whomever one of its machines is attacking. That's a weird situation that we don't tolerate in any other phase of our consumer technology. We don't expect that our refrigerator is freelancing by chilling other people's food when we're not looking. We don't think that our televisions, if you tune them to the wrong station, come down with a virus and they don't work anymore. And then you call up Sky or BBC or whatever, they're like, were you watching Channel 3 last night? Yes, I thought so. That's your problem. It's not our problem. You have to reinitialize your television set. Like, that's weird, and yet we think of it as a commonplace on our platforms. Even visiting the wrong website can fry your machine. So, for example, this is chuckroast.com, which counterintuitively sells fleece. Chuck Roast is a nice guy, but his site got hacked because he has bad site security, because he's an amateur and he's, you know, off in left field. And the hacker, which was probably a robot, made the smallest change to his site. It put in exactly this one line of code. This is the line of code that when you encounter the site with your unpatched browser, you lose. Your computer is suddenly completely under the control of some faraway unknown party, unknown to you, unknown to Chuck Roast, and you leave. You didn't even have to buy a sweater to get it, and that's it. It's all over. So I say that there are ways in which this circumstance will go beyond the mere annoyance into the realm where people will start reacting and moving away from generative technologies, because there's no other way to easily solve the problem. The fundamental problem is represented by this, the Cap'n Crunch Bosun's Whistle, a prize in a box of American children's cereal in the early 1970s. After you've sugared up your child, why not have her run around the house and blow a whistle? It's a perfect partner kind of thing. Turns out if you cover one hole of the Cap'n Crunch whistle and blow, it emits a tone of 2600 hertz, which is exactly the tone used by AT&T, the monopoly telephone provider in America at the time, to indicate an idle line. Pick up the phone, blow the whistle, you get free long-distance telephone calling. General Mills has a VisiCalc moment. Boxes of cereal are flying off the shelves. They have no idea why. They figure out there's a new third-party app for their rolled oats. And the real problem was something that AT&T could fix, because the telephone network was meant to be sterile. It wasn't supposed to be generative. It was just supposed to carry sound so people could talk from one end to the other. So they were able to fix their network by separating, as they shouldn't have been together to begin with, the channel of communication from the channel of control. Communication is for the customer. Control is for the network operator. That's the sterile, non-generative environment. So they fixed it. They made it so that out-of-band signaling was the way that bits went back and forth, if it was to control it. The internet is still at exactly this phase. The channels that carry our emails, our music files, our web surfing are also the conduits that carry EXE on the fly so that our computers can be reprogrammed in ways large and small at any instant as we use them or as we just leave them on unattended. And I say that situation is approaching a certain crucial threshold of untenability that will change our entire ecosystem. I think about it like the phenomenon of hitchhiking. It was not that long ago a totally normal thing to do, to get into a stranger's car and have him or her take you closer to where you were trying to go. A lot like best efforts routing, right? It's just, there's no contract, there's no bargain, unless you call it a social one. It's just, I'd like your help. That's internet protocol at the social level. And it worked until it didn't, because at some point in our consciousness, we got the lurid idea that this is not safe. And we then found other ways, generally ways mediated by commerce. You buy a car or you have a taxi take you, and then that's regulated in a way that makes us feel safer, that end up making it a smoother, we think, less risky experience. Exactly the same phenomenon, I say, will happen with our PC as we know it. As, especially in corporate environments, rationally, the CIOs are locking them down. You can't install that flying toaster screensaver anymore because who knows what else it comes with. Sensible decision. And we see people starting to migrate away from the PC and towards what I call a new range of information appliances. The revenge of the Frieden FlexiWriter. Things like a Sky Plus box. It might have GNU Linux inside, a free software system that anybody can reprogram, but good luck. This is the only way you can control the box, and that's the end of the story. Or the BlackBerry, or most but not all mobile phones. This is a singular mobile phone. Here's the singular provided menu. Does it look familiar, right? It's like, wow, I see the past in this object. The Kindle, the iPod, pictured in its pink Naugahyde coating, or the iPhone. This thing is gorgeous, but wow, if CompuServe were alive today, it might have an action for copyright infringement. Like, there's the CompuServe main menu with nicer buttons. Exactly the same ethos built into this phone, which is what we thought our generative technologies at the network and hardware level had replaced 20, 30 years ago. Steve Jobs in 2007 made no apologies for this. He says he is satisfying market demand, and by all accounts, he is. People want the thing to work. They don't want to load in something that they don't exactly know what it is, and then the phone doesn't work anymore. He is responding to us in giving us technology that is locking down the prospect of the dark energy of people coding from who knows where, doing new and surprising and cool stuff. They can't easily get it into our lives if the main physical windows that we use to get to the network tend to be this new generation of appliances that are back to the future. That's one huge concern I talk about in the book. Now, some of you may be thinking, well, wait a minute, didn't Steve Jobs announce a software development kit for the iPhone? Didn't he cave into the idea that outsiders could do really cool things and CompuServe shouldn't control the whole thing? There is now a way for outsiders to code for the phone. This is not, by the way, a real Newsweek cover. It would have been a very slow Newsweek had this been the cover of Newsweek. But it's the right level of Newsweek exaggeration, I think. And the answer is yes, Steve Jobs has done this, but wow, look at the fine print. If you have an iPhone and I'm a nerd and I've written something cool for your iPhone, I can't give it to you. I have to send it through Steve Jobs by way of the iPhone apps store. If I want to charge you for it, Steve will take a cut. If I charge you nothing, he takes nothing. But if he doesn't like it, it won't run. That's it. He gets to decide prospectively and retroactively what apps will exist on that phone. What criteria will he use? We don't know. Most pictures of Steve Jobs are fuzzy, but this picture from his introduction of the software development kit gives us a hint. Illegal, malicious, privacy, porn, bandwidth hog, and my favorite, unforeseen. We wouldn't want something unforeseen happening on the phone. And the unforeseen is exactly the trump card of the generative environment that does truly disruptive innovation rather than just more, bigger, faster, louder. And that is the engine I'm worrying will come sputtering to a halt. I see, by the way, a big connection between these endpoint devices that are responsive to the vendor even after you've bought them from the factory, so that the vendor is privileged in how they will operate, with new online cloud computing platforms meant to attract dark energy to them. So like the Facebook apps platform. If you're a young nerd writing for fun today and you're poorly dressed and brilliant and asocial, chances are good you're writing a Facebook app. You write the app, you can share it with your friends, right? Anybody been bitten by a vampire recently, right? That's a bee that shouldn't have flown. Did that make it over here that you're a chump, right? Man, nobody wants to admit it, right? So Facebook reserves the right at any time to kill any app. I mean, why wouldn't it? Although then you compare it to what that nerd would have been writing for had Facebook never existed. That nerd 10 years ago, the nerd would have been writing for Windows XP, which of course didn't reserve the right to kill any application running on Bill Gates' platform if Bill Gates doesn't like it. They reserve the right to charge a fee that they can calculate however they want for your app to continue running. Can you imagine Bill Gates saying to some app maker on a Windows machine, "That's a great piece of software you've had running for 3 years. You've really got some good market share. I'd like $1 million by Wednesday." It's up to you. You know, if you don't want to pay it, we'll just kill the app. It's totally your call. And I'll see you again on Sunday. Right? That's weird. And it has benefits to it. This is the Secret Crush app, which was wildly popular on Facebook, but I've never found anybody willing to admit having subscribed to it. The Secret Crush app turns out to be installing adware. Wired puts out that report on January 3rd. By January 7th, that's it. Bye-bye, Secret Crush. Facebook has killed it. That's solving the cap-and-crunch whistle problem, but I claim at a price so steep that I am desperate to find a third way through so we're not stuck between platforms controlled by one vendor on the one hand and generative platforms that end up biting us once they become popular on the other. Because you can start to see ways in which not just the vendor can get tricky with it, but regulators can come after the vendor. So Scrabulous gets invented, plays Scrabble, but it's not really Scrabble. And Hasbro's like, "No, it really is Scrabble, and we have the license, and you don't." And the two guys from India that invented it told Hasbro to go to hell. So Hasbro goes to Facebook and says, "Get rid of it." Facebook is eminently able to do so. And a judge then is eminently able to tell Facebook to do so in a way that had the music industry had the power to tell Bill Gates to kill every instance of Kazaa immediately, I am very confident that that would have happened. And it's only because that disruption persisted for a while and then BBC decided that was a cool way to distribute their programming totally legally that we now see, oh, peer-to-peer, kind of interesting. Maybe it's not as awful as it's been made out to be. One last footnote on this front. I think about a world in which our devices can be updated at any moment by their vendors as a profoundly weird world. I imagine a world in which I come down and I look at my toaster and it has a third slot one Wednesday morning. And it's like a sign on it says, "Congratulations, the summer update has arrived. You have a third slot." I'm like, cool. And I come down the next morning and it's back to two. It says, "Sorry, there was a bug in the upgrade. We've retrofitted it back to the old one. Stay tuned, and we apologize for any toast crushed in the rollback." And then you come back the next week, and it's making orange juice. And you're like, "What did I buy? I didn't buy a toaster. I bought a relationship with a vendor for breakfast satisfaction. And that's weird." Now, maybe the vendor has motives as pure as the driven snow, right? Wonder Bread, yeah, great. You're going to be doing good things to me. But it means that I can't relate to this the way that I used to relate to stuff where it was mine, I knew what it was, and not everything had a public back to the rest of humanity tether that allows not only the vendor to control it for reasons that they think might be amenable to us, but the government to control the vendor, just like with the example on Scrabulous. So two very quick examples. Number one is the case of TiVo versus EchoStar. These are digital video recorders competing with one another in the United States. TiVo sues EchoStar for making this DVR that they say infringes the TiVo patent. TiVo wins. They get a judgment for $90 million against EchoStar. Fine. Then they ask for more, and they get it. They get an order from the judge telling EchoStar that within 30 days, EchoStar must remotely disable all but a handful of the DVRs already in living rooms everywhere. You come up one Wednesday morning, there's been a feature upgrade to your Echo Star. It's now an Echo Brick. It doesn't work anymore. And that's weird, because it used to be that if you had a mousetrap and the mousetrap was found to be infringing a patent, it's not like the patent police would knock on your door and say, like, how many mousetraps do you have? We need to inspect them. I know we live in a land where the TV police sometimes come in to make sure you don't have any televisions. I've been threatened several times. But that's still, to me, very weird. And you realize if they can kill the thing remotely, they could also change the content remotely. Here's something that went out on BBC, and oops, it's defamatory. Oops, it prejudices some defendant's right to a fair trial. Let's get an order recalling it. You know those pathetic emails that some email systems send that say, John Smith would like to recall the previous email. You're like, where's the previous email? I want to read it, right? Now you can do that kind of thing with the tethered appliance. Another example is OnStar. It's a GPS system in many American vehicles. It helps you get from one place to another. It also has a microphone conveniently in the rearview mirror. So if you run into help, you press the help button, you say, help, help. And then this lady, this is the actual lady, is like, don't worry, help is on the way. So the FBI cottoned on to this and demanded that a car company that operates one of these things tweak the OnStar system of a car containing people of interest to the FBI so the microphone simply switched on. And they could listen to everything happening inside the car at any time with just the touch of a button remotely. The car company was not happy, but did this, and then objected, filing a case that should go down in history given its title. That's right, the company versus the United States of America. The company lost in the first round in a decision that's under appeal, and then it appealed, as I said, to the Ninth Circuit, and the company won on the thinnest of reeds. The judge found that because the way the FBI demanded that the system be reprogrammed, at all times the stuff is going to the FBI, if the bad guys go into a ditch and hit the help button, it doesn't go to the lady, at which point the FBI presumably would not come and help. So that's not fair, they said. If you could make it so it goes to the FBI all the time, but when you press the help button it goes to the lady too, no problem. That would be fine. So speaking of the United States of America, I start to think about journalism and the future of media, and I see the same tensions between generative and sterile platforms, simply without, for the past 30 years, having this detour through the fascinating and bumpy landscape of generative mainstream technology. Journalism has been much more sterile in that time. And again, I hope it's clear, by pivoting up this dichotomy, I don't mean to say two legs bad, four legs good, sterile always bad, generative always good. There are times we don't want generativity. I don't want generative chemistry available to everybody. Same with physics, probably, too, right? We have trouble enough with, like, the Large Hadron Collider about to go online, possibly creating a chain reaction that will destroy the entire universe. It's like, we don't want people doing that in their backyards. We only want accredited scientists destroying the entire universe. So I start to think of that, and I think of a backdrop, then, of many, many years in which there have been difficulties in soliciting third-party contribution from odd corners that can easily get to a mass audience. That's the generative distinction, and thereby produce surprises. Instead, we have a fairly well-known configuration, still with plenty of competition, just like CompuServe, AOL, etc., but competition among parties that are still large enough that the government can regulate them, that they can afford and hire lawyers, and that they can decide under what circumstances, on pain of legal liability themselves if they should choose poorly, under what circumstances to allow members of the public in a letter to the editor or a It's Your Voice Too Vox Pop segment to sound off. And I see the ways in which the major players, of course, are not just the media. The government has a voice, too, and a role. Here's Donald Rumsfeld talking about how we have to see that the terrorists these days, in this new generative environment, they've got media committees. They're out there trying to manipulate the press, and they're much better at manipulation than we are. And we've got to get better at that, he says. How do they get better at that? Well, you see things like this United States Air Force Psychological Operations Manual. Planned operations to convey selected information and indicators to foreign audiences to influence their emotions, motives, objective reasoning, and ultimately the behavior of foreign governments, organizations, groups, and individuals. The purpose of PSYOPs is to induce or reinforce foreign attitudes and behavior favorable to the originator's objectives. You know, if it weren't so, like, kind of lame, you'd be like, wow, that's a little weird. But of course, it's what every government, I suppose, is trying to do. ours, by ours I mean mine, somewhat ham-handedly. So we had this flap. For all I know, you guys broke this flap. You may have. Somebody did. About the Lincoln Group, a private contractor, that had a Department of Defense deal to work in Baghdad. And what was their work providing strategic communication services? It was to bribe people to plant op-eds written by the Lincoln Group under their name in the Iraqi media that were like, the U.S. rocks. So we've developed a certain degree of competence and professionalism, particularly in information operations, that's recognized by the client. This is from the Director of Insight and Influence for Lincoln. Do you guys have a Director of Insight and Influence? It's kind of a cool title. And after it was revealed that these op-eds were getting placed for a fee like that, there was a bit of a flap, as you might guess, and there was an internal review that concluded that it was perfectly fine to use a contractor to conduct these psychological operations. And this is another example that sits with me because it also has a domestic flavor. There's the long-respected tool of an official government communication for which the government is allowed to tell the press present that what they say is anonymous or not, it's off the record or not, or it's on background or not. And the press basically goes with it. So they start on the record, and here it is. This is the White House website talking about an on-the-record transcript of a conversation. And then at some point, notice he says we're going to start on the record, and then we're going to go off the record. So at some point in the middle of the transcript, they go off the record, and it just becomes senior administration official in the transcript. It's the same guy talking. He just became senior administration official. Then you look at the way in which the newspapers report it. This is the New York Times, American paper of record, old gray lady, and here's the report. The president has confidence, says Tony Snow. Two senior administration officials who insisted on anonymity in exchange for talking about a classified memo said it was unclear, blah, 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 one official said. That was just later in the press conference. Sure makes it sound like with the whole insisted on yada yada. That sounds like they were like in a parking lot somewhere. You know, I've got the goods. Are you sure? Deep throat kind of thing. This is the Washington Post doing exactly the same thing. Tony Snow says blah, blah, blah. And then two senior administration officials said, yada, yada, yada. They noted, blah, blah, blah. Another senior official returned to the... I mean, wow. What a weird relation between the government and the regulated parties. And make no mistake, they are regulated in doing this. It took a blog. This is 2006. This is not that long ago. A blog to say, wait a minute, this is like absurd. White House officials magically become anonymous halfway through the briefing. Like, hello, this is weird. What's the reaction of the White House? They do a briefing the day after where Snow says, first, I'm joined by my close personal friend, namely himself, senior administration official. So I'm going to introduce you all to senior administration official to give you a readout. Then he just says, thank you. I should start. Now, it's nice to see Tony has a sense of humor. It's also profoundly weird because this only works in a social, professional, and yes, market and technological configuration where you don't have two guys from left field who are mischievous, smiley, poorly dressed, brilliant, and young to say, this is bizarre. I'm going to say that I witnessed Tony Snow say X, and you know, so sue me. That's what Tony Snow said to a room full of witnesses. And you start to see in the official channels ways in which two guys with the kind of obsessive compulsive disorder that drives Wikipedia content, starting to apply it to what they see in the news. So, for example, during the Israel-Lebanon-Israel-Hezbollah war, there were these moving pictures of stuffed animals that were, like, left after the bombing. And then just some random bloggers were like, they seem awfully clean, don't they? And then they look through some more of the photos, and they actually find a guy with a suitcase of these children's toys. Now, I don't know if he's packing them or unpacking them. There's all sorts of explanations for this. But this is what rarely makes it beyond the photo editor's desk and into the explanation. Or this, again, from the New York Times, turmoil in the Middle East, reports from Israel and Lebanon. Tuesday strike, which wounded 12 people, been the third. So here are some images from the strike. You see them dealing with the terrible aftermath. And here is a guy that appears to be dead with the caption saying, the mayor of Tyre said that in the worst hit areas, bodies were still buried under the rubble. He appealed to the Israelis to allow the authorities time to pull them out. Then somebody just looked more closely at it, and they said, wait a minute. This guy has a green hat on, and he's helping. And now I look at it, and this is the same guy, and there's the green hat. He's holding the green hat in the crook of his arm, which means that if he was wounded, he was at least wounded after the picture was taken, not at the time of the rubble. It's that kind of obsessive compulsiveness that leads to a productive, to me, new clash between the sterile and the generative in the space. Another example that you might be familiar with, this is a photo of smoke rising after Israeli bombs taking place. But then here's little green footballs, a really conservative guy who loves Israel and doesn't like Israel's enemies. He's the guy that says, wait a minute, these plumes of smoke have been cloned in Photoshop, and so have the buildings. Look, you can actually see that it's the same plume, and somebody just did a very nasty copy and paste job. There's the before, there's what was made into. So that was, I think, one of them is the real one of them is the fake one. I forget which. One last example, Israeli F-16 warplane fires missiles during an airstrike. Well, it turns out that also was just copied and pasted. And this is something that appears in Reuters. This is not like some blogger put it up. This came through the mainstream media. At first, Reuters denied it, said that it was perfectly fine. Then they thought about it more, and we knew that they had retracted when the Yahoo page containing the picture was now empty. It's just like, sorry, I don't know what picture you're looking for, but it's not here. Then pressure built among the blogosphere, and you ended up with a statement from Reuters. I love this statement. My favorite part of it is to say that the rule of thumb in the news business is that you must not do more with Photoshop than you used to do in a darkroom in the days of 35mm film, which is nicely indexed to whatever level of media manipulation you were already doing. Don't do more, but it'd be unfair to ask that people do less. So this, to me, then turns us back over to the question of the identity of a journalistic enterprise that from all accounts, certainly from what I can tell, is highly aware of the generative environment out there. This is the organization that started Comment is Free. This is the organization that is doing this series on the future of journalism and trying to think deeply about how to retain the best strands of professionalism, what we think of as the best of the non-generative environment, where there is a distinction between the reader and the writer, or the reader and the reporter, or the reader and the editor, and a healthy one, because those reporters and writers and editors are professionals in the best sense of the word professional. Not they have more expertise necessarily, although they probably do, but that they subscribe to a professional ethos, a code of conduct, a set of ethics that says, if somebody sends me something to review and they give me a check with it for £20, it's not okay to cash it and then write the review, even if I think that I haven't let it influence me, or I give the £20 to charity, or that I will write what I see. And even though I have a view, and you'll find out that view maybe in the article, and if you don't like my view, go read the Times, that my view is somehow, it's a difference between neutrality and objectivity, and working that through professionally. Taking those elements of the sterile, of the non-generative, and trying to blend them with the generative, of figuring out how to have inputs open wide enough that people out of left field can give you tips, can provide information and leads, and maybe even provide direct content that is meaningful to the mission that you guys have as a solemn public trust. That's the hybrid blending that we are seeing taking place so interestingly and weirdly in the technology space that I think is happening in the social space of journalism as well. And that's the discussion I would love at this point to open up, but also to see if there are questions or comments on any of the breathless and kaleidoscopic attempted presentation I've just done. Thank you very much. There's a hand up back there. Sure.
Its days were numbered. Is that what you were saying, in the sense that companies would fight back and install these protections?
I am, in fact, saying that the status quo as we know it is not tenable. It is as brittle as 1992 Soviet Union, and when it collapses like a souffle, we may not even notice. Kind of the way we didn't really notice the Soviet Union went away. There's still a bunch of people over there doing weird shit. But I see, not necessarily through a 9/11 style crucial moment, although in chapter 3 of the book, I do my best at describing plausibly, although not likely, how such a moment could come about. I talk about a way in which if you were really out to do evil, you would create a worm that infects the standard, 20-30% of machines out there, looks for spreadsheets and randomly transposes some numbers in them and then goes back to sleep. And 3 weeks later, somebody's doing payroll and nothing adds up. Like, that's demonic, right? You can't trust any spreadsheets after that. You could see something that would be enough fitting into the category of information warfare or, you know, one fine Tuesday morning, wow, we've been all clocked by this generative technology, that you would see pressure for immediate and hasty and ill-considered solutions, including the equivalent of a Patriot Act for cyberspace. But what I think of as even more plausible, this is the souffle part I'm talking about, is one company at a time and one consumer at a time, we will start to lock down the generative environment built for hobbyists in 77, the kinds of hobbyists who show up at West Coast Computer Fair, who build their own radio rather than buy one because it's more fun to take 2 weeks to do something that doesn't work, that is no longer a suitable technology for the public at large. And what I worry is that we'll see a race to the other side of the spectrum towards locking it down and towards these tethered and sterile or contingently generative devices. And I'm very interested, the last third of the book that we haven't talked about are ways to try to see a middle path through so we preserve the generative stuff that I think is so important while acknowledging the very real problems that say, if we are going to return to an era of hitchhiking, we can't do it the way we used to, which was just eye contact, into the car you go. And you actually see it with Craigslist now. Talk about a weird phenomenon, by the way. A guy named Craig that has a list. that's it. And he's still, what's his job? He's the chief customer service guy. He sits and answers emails all day long from people who have problems with Craigslist. Right? This is a weird, profoundly weird fellow. And he's like taking down the newspaper industry. And it's like you can't even blame him for being like a rapacious mercenary Rupert Murdoch or something. Does Rupert Murdoch own you guys? No, right? I didn't think so. I was kidding. Something like Craigslist is actually reinvigorating hitchhiking. There's now the, you know, Oxford London ride board, and people post and say, I need a ride, and they just figure that the kind of people that use Craigslist are not the kind of people that would kill you. Just that extra layer may be a way of bringing back some of the things we thought we had lost forever. Yeah.
China seems to have, quite successfully controlled some of the more left-field aspects of its internet users' activity, and Russia has talked about doing the same thing with its own kind of separate internet. Have you got any insights into, how the authorities have managed to do that, or have they actually managed to do that?
I'm glad you asked. The other book I came out with this spring is called Access Denied, The Policy and Practice of Global Internet Filtering. And I did the first studies of internet filtering in China in 2002. Hearing rumors of this, I was like, well, what do they filter? And no one knew. So I placed a long-distance international phone call from my office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, to a Beijing dial-up ISP, as if I were in a Beijing hotel and needing to get online, and just started asking for one website after another and figuring out which ones I could get to and which ones I couldn't. And within 2 weeks, had a fairly decent list of the kinds of things that China filters. That worked great until the dean got the telephone bill. I had to move to other mechanisms to do the enumeration. The answer is China has one of the most sophisticated and far-reaching regimes of filtering in the world. It conscripts many local parties, certainly the ISPs, but also content providers who are local, to do the filtering so that you see it happening at several stages, at the source of the information, at the internet service provider as it's routing the information to you, all that kind of stuff. They deny doing it, which is interesting. In Saudi Arabia, they're so excited about doing it. They're like, can we tell you about, ask me about my filtering kind of thing. And then they don't filter very much. So it's a loud bark and no bite. China is a loud bite and not much of a bark. My understanding, though, is first that it's difficult to measure public opinion, but there is a decent chunk of the public that thinks this is a good thing. It's like, that's what the government is there to do. That filtering is bound up in a whole portfolio of public safety and public protection measures against fraud and other things on the net. and that what China cares about most are the middle 80%, which is to say 20% of the people are nerds or determined enough that they're going to find a way to get to the information they want, and they will evade the filters. And for the most part, it seems like evading the filters is like a parking ticket kind of wrong. You don't go to jail for it. You're not in big trouble. It's just nothing personal. We're trying to prevent you from getting here, and if you manage to do it, oh well. But what they care about is enough of a speed bump so that the masses will be diverted from BBC and to some other site. And we find it ourselves, I think, if you're trying to get to some website and it takes like 20 seconds, like you're out of there. You're already going somewhere else. I think you were thinking, though, maybe I wasn't, I don't know, was there a follow-up or a...
No, I mean, you've basically answered the question, which is that it's you kind of need the complicity of your own people then if the government wants to censor the internet to
that
extent.
So that's a great point. Uh-oh, I'm about to kill the connection. Complicity, wonderful word, because with technologies that are not tightly coupled or tethered, the way that I claim this new generation of technologies that we are asking for will be and are, think GPS in the car kind of technologies, the government needed to expend effort and to obtain complicity in order to achieve its regulatory or surveillance end. A great example from American history is the American Civil War. Prior to it, there was rocky relations North and South, and basically an uneasy deal where the North agreed that fugitive slaves escaping from the South would be returned. And there wasn't enough person power among normally deputized sheriffs to do this. So the way you normally do something if you don't have enough energy to do it is you have posse comitatus. You actually conscript or request that the citizens at large join a posse. Let's all join together and return this slave. You can imagine that, like, of the hierarchy of things to do on a Sunday night, like, that's at the very, very bottom. And as a result, many slaves were not returned to the South because there was no complicity to do it, no shared norm about it, where if they had run maybe from one southern state to another, it'd be easy to raise the posse given that social configuration. My worry is that we are entering a time newly where the levels of complicity that used to be needed for a modern government, whether under the rule of law or not, to engage in special surveillance or regulatory control, that number is plummeting. That GPS just took one company and one official at that company. And the U.S. regulatory regime in the first cut of the Patriot Act was, you can't even tell your lawyer that we've asked you to do this. You must do it or you go to jail. And then you have people, that one person targeted, who then flips the switch and turns on the microphone in the car. So I'm greatly concerned about a new range of technologies that just basically, as China has realized that the only reason it gets as far as it does is because of complicity, or the music and movie industries have realized that digital rights management hits a ceiling pretty quickly because most people don't want to be complicit in that scheme, that we're handing them ways to get done what they want to without needing that complicity. In a China in which most people are using BlackBerries or iPhones, China can turn to Steve Jobs and say, we yank your license and we arrest your engineers unless you program the iPhone to block the following sites, to prevent the following apps, and to surveil the following communications. Skype, right? I held out Skype as the example of the two loony guys all over the place. By the time they're doing Skype, that's their second big venture. They're in it for the money now. And the Chinese language localized version of Skype, under the pressure of the Chinese government, automatically in Skype text chat filters out words deemed sensitive. So you can't convey the word democracy in a Skype text chat. So that's a great example to me of how newly tethered centralized technologies could change this current status quo of China's trying hard, but it only gets to where it's going thanks to complicity. I'm sorry to keep the answers so long. I'll shorten them. Yeah.
I ask a question? It's kind of two questions in one, but the old newspaper model relied on mass advertising to many, and newspapers are now very interested in personalized information, so knowing who you are when you come to us. So it's kind of a question about what you think the future of cookies stroke privacy will be, whether that is a doomed enterprise in trying to, and where that blurs with people's desire for anonymity on the web.
Yes. Could people hear that in the back? The relation between cookies, privacy, personalization, particularly in the advertising space, where is that going? Now, this, of course, is looking into the crystal ball again. The first thing I do is look back a little bit, and I'm amazed at the sine wave, where at the crest of the dot-com boom in 1998-99, it's like, we're building all this stuff. We're plowing money into it. It's really popular. We don't charge anybody anything. How do we make our money? Volume. But it's like, advertising. And then the dot-com bust happens. You're like, advertising? Well, that was so stupid. What were we thinking? And now it's 2008, and we're like, advertising. And you actually realize that certainly on American TV, I mean, here there's this whole gravitational depression formed by the BBC and the television licensing model that plows like £1 billion a year, roughly, into producing television. Certainly in America, the free TV model, to an order of magnitude, I think it's $150 billion a year in television and related advertising. You look at the size of the domestic U.S. music industry, selling people CDs before it even started getting dented, it was like $8 billion a year. Sales of Microsoft Office alone, $6 billion a year. So it sort of puts in perspective how much money is flowing having to do with advertising versus the we sell it to you and you pay us money kind of model. Shopping cart theft, $800 million a year. Who knew? Shopping cart theft. Like, wow. So I see a lot of that money starting to get pushed into the online space. A while ago, not that long ago, if you were an advertiser and it just for whatever reason you were restricted to only television advertising, it wouldn't be that big a deal, or traditional media advertising. Now, just like, would you rather have an article about you that's important to you and your business appear in the Guardian print edition only or the web edition only? When would you have marked the date at which the right answer to that question was the web edition if I had to choose? I assume that's the answer now. I don't know. Certainly for nytimes.com, people would much rather have it online than in the physical paper. Similarly, that $100 billion a year is going to start funneling into the online space. The first step, the first stop for that is going to be Google, both for placing ads during Google search and the AdWords syndication scheme, which appears on sites. Now we start to get to personalization because Google has lots of very smart PhDs, economists and engineers, trying to figure out how to show you exactly the ad that will make you click on the damn ad, because if you click on the damn ad, they get a penny or whatever the cost is on the click-through. I'm hoping, by the way, to tie it to the last question, that Google does not get it in its head to apply that kind of brilliance to the question of filtering in China and surveillance so that they can easily say, people interested in these websites are also interested in these subversive websites. And we can tell the government who the subversives are before they even know it themselves. I mean, that's the kind of thing you want to do with advertising that you would not want to do with political subversion. The things to me to watch for are whether there start to be clever modes of price discrimination using personalization. This is also in the field called CRM, Customer Relationship Management. Amazon.com did the smallest of experiments on this in the late 1990s. They started randomly charging different prices to different Amazon subscribers for the same DVD. And a couple hackers discovered this and all hell broke loose. How dare you? And they pulled back. But it's funny. If I were to ask you guys, how would you feel if when Alan goes to the page for my book on Amazon, he's quoted a price of £7. And when Catherine goes, she's quoted a price of £15. Why? Because we've noticed that when Catherine surfs on Amazon.com, the smallest of nanoseconds elapses before she sees the page and clicks buy at one click. She doesn't even care about the price. She just is trigger happy. Whereas Alan kind of, you know, he sneaks up to the cheese, he sniffs, he backs off, he goes back, he sniffs, and then eventually he bites. All right, we're going to give him a discount to attract him. Let me just take a poll. How many people think that practice is highly objectionable? Should a website be doing it? Wow. All right, here's the follow-up law professor question. Suppose the sticker price of the book is £20. Alan is offered a special Amazon discount, frequent visitor, special customer discount of £13, and Catherine is offered a discount of £5. And they both see the sticker price, but they have a chance to click to apply their just-in-time instant discount. How many object heavily to that? Okay. Can I point out that it's the same thing, right? We know that too. It's so weird how much what social configuration it tries to mimic completely influences our sense of outrage about a given practice. And my guess is there will be lots of discoveries made about how to do the things with cookies and with personalization that on one dimension seem totally objectionable, and how to just repackage them so the same aim is met by the vendor, but that to us it seems perfectly innocuous. And that's one of my, I don't know, is it a fear or a happy thing about the future of privacy, that by the time personalization really cuts in, we won't really care.
Are you surprised there hasn't been more alarm, customer resistance at what is widely happening?
I think, am I surprised if there's been more alarm? I think I'm not surprised. People tend on privacy to want the cheapest possible thing at all times. That's why you use your Nectar card that associates all your purchases to the store with you, because you also get a discount off a loaf of bread for it. And only when there's a certain instance that singles you out and gets you in trouble do you retroactively regret what you did. And to me, one of the most important things to advocate for in privacy is not so much this ought to be your policy, or you ought to have some general opt-out that the obsessive-compulsive can follow the links to opt-out and the rest get stuck with it, but rather a nice ongoing way to casually audit what information has been gathered about you and generally what they're doing with it. A little more transparency about that. And that might get us to exactly the right level of horror and paranoia as to where we should be, instead of some people having too much and some people having too little. I should add that to me, the most interesting threats to privacy, I talk about this a little bit in Chapter 9 of the book, are not so much in the two-party configuration where there's a poor citizen and either a government or a corporation gathering information about the citizen, and we fear the government databank, CCTV, or we fear the corporation gathering tons of data about what we purchase and then doing something later with it. Rather, the most interesting problems to me are what I think of as peer-to-peer privacy problems, that almost any moment now, if it is at all unusual, can become an instant subject of recording and conveyance to the world at large, something that, of course, is impacting journalism when you know that, you know, 7/7 happens, and then the first video streaming out is from mobile phones and amateur stuff, and how do you deal with that deluge? It's so easy for that to become decontextualized, or even if it's not decontextualized but accurate, an event among citizens that has some moral dimension to it, which is what makes it interesting. Dog poop girl in Korea. People heard of dog poop girl? This is the woman who on the subway, her dog is on the subway and it takes a crap. And people are just like, your dog just crapped on the subway. And she doesn't seem to care. And a gentleman finally hands her a tissue and she uses it to clean off the leash but not the floor. And then she leaves and then the guy goes over with his own tissue, cleans up the floor. Somebody gets this on a mobile phone camera. They post the pictures. It becomes a wanted, does anybody know who this girl is? The dog is very distinctive. People know who it is in her own neighborhood. And then from then on, she is dog poop girl. And people think that they owe her a good yelling at, because surely no one else has taken her to task yet over that incident. And her life becomes sort of a living hell. And I'm nervous about ways, large and small, in which the most innocent of activities, somebody's taking a tour in London, you take pictures, and just advance to 2010 instead of 2008. Your camera is hooked into the municipal Wi-Fi. As you're taking the pictures, they're going up to Flickr. They're getting date stamped, time stamped, location stamped with GPS. We know exactly where the picture was taken and at what angle. And we also know who's in it because we do image recognition on the basis of new technologies coming out. It doesn't have to be people you know. If they're at all in the database anywhere, there'll be a name hooked up to their other photos. And now you have a database created by the Army of the World's Tourists that let you, I mean, think about Google Street View. It's like, who needs that? We've got everything covered already. And we can ask who entered or left The Guardian over the past 24 hours. We can ask who entered or left this protest or this reproductive health clinic or this animal testing lab. Or we can say, show me everywhere Alan has been caught on film in the past 2 weeks. That's when things start to get to me weird. And how to deal with that phenomenon, again, a problem of too much generativity in a way, without careening towards lock it all down, ban it, we've got to get sterile again, we've got to just have a few authorities that collect and disseminate such powerful information. That's, again, the needle I want to thread. Yeah.
You talk about this rather kind of haphazard development of these technologies.
Yes.
And there's the balance between citizens, between the guys, yes, with OCD, between the government as well. Who has responsibility for making sure things go in the right direction?
Yes. I think, so the question is, who has responsibility to make sure things go well? And it sounds so naive and like 60s New York Woodstock of me to be like, why, it's our responsibility. But the funny thing is, the more I looked at it first, the more that answer is what powers the traditional internet, the traditional PC, and in fact, Wikipedia as well. When you see a page that's inaccurate or vandalized, there are people who are moved to clean it up, even though they've never visited the page before. They have no other affiliation. Nobody's paying them to do it. Economists write papers. It's like, what's wrong with these people? And I'll tell you what the key is, I think, for them. It's that they identify with the instrumentality. They identify with Wikipedia. They are Wikipedians. And so many other attempts to corral public participation and opinion still have them at a different hierarchy. Your volunteers, your docents, your, you know, please, commenters, you can comment here, but you can't do anything above the fold sort of thing. And I think that that then puts people in opposition to the platform or the instrumentality, and it means that they don't take responsibility for keeping it nice. I think to the extent that comment is free is a better environment for comment than most of the corresponding newspapers that at the end of the story have this just like sequential comments one after the other, is that there are people who feel like they own part of comment is free, that like that's their home. That's where they go to every day, and they use it. And that's certainly true of Wikipedia, and not true of your refrigerator. If your refrigerator breaks, you call somebody who's responsible for fixing it. To the extent that we adopt solutions that say we have to call somebody to fix it or ask the government to pass a law to fix it, we're treating it like a sterile technology, and we will get the network we deserve and that we expect to see. To the extent that we can see ourselves as participating in fixing it, we can sustain it in this bizarre mode that I totally concede is like Wile E. Coyote running off the cliff and just not looking down for a while, and until he looks down, he won't fall. So I have some ideas in the last third of the book as to how we could actually do that. One example, jumping back to the problem of enumerating internet filtering, is to create a plugin for Firefox so that as people are surfing the net, if they can't get to a website, they click a "Why can't I get there from here?" button. The act of clicking that button shares the fact that they can't get there with all other participating browsers that have the button. And if you accumulate all the answers, which is to say the questions, "Why can't I get there?" you get the answer, because you start to see that everybody in China is asking why they can't get to the Beeb, and nobody else is. We can start to make inferences about what's going on in the network and by whom. And I mean, we're actually writing the software so it can be done, and running parallel software for the network security model so that PCs can radiate their vital signs. How happy am I right now? What software am I running, and how happy am I? How often am I rebooting? How often am I crashing? That kind of stuff. And the people who run the software can even say, I'm not an expert or I am an expert. And there's no cost or benefit to saying one or the other. You're just supposed to be honest. And with it, I could then ask all participating users with the software before I run new code, by the way, is it code that a bunch of amateurs are running, like non-experts, and no expert seems to want to run? That might give me a hint about whether I should run it, whether I'm an expert or not. Or is this code that the herd just discovered last week, rather than it's been floating around for 3 years? That might change my view as to how risky it is to run it. All of these are solutions that ask for people to devote rationally a little bit of bandwidth, a little bit of processor cycles, answer a few questions in ways that when you agglomerate it with everybody else become very powerful. Without those kinds of solutions, I agree, we are back to the dichotomy of we stay naive and we keep hitchhiking and people keep disappearing, or we shut it down and we go to the standard .com or .gov models, .co or .gov models, of asking some experts other than us to run the system for us. Yeah.
I'm one of those people who doesn't use a Nectar card, a discount card, because I don't like the store to know what I'm purchasing. Is there a way of searching on Google or reading the Guardian website and those companies or organizations not knowing what I'm looking at?
No. I mean, yes, in theory. In practice, it's a bizarre thing. You can say, you know, each computer on the net generally has its own identifying number for that moment, an internet protocol address. You can't treat it like some secret number because every single entity with whom you communicate, you send your IP address to, subject to exceptions we won't talk about. And they then know who you are, at least by number. And then it's like, are you the number that visited me yesterday? I'm going to start making generalizations about you. In Google's bag of tricks, they set a cookie that Alan was talking about earlier. And one question is, well, should it last for, what was their initial bid, 36 years? Or should it be only 18 months? I think they picked 36 years, so 18 months was like, wow, they really met us more than halfway. In addition to the cookie, there's the sign-in, and you know it's a single sign-in. So if you use any island in the Google archipelago, you're using Google Mail, and you sign in, and you don't sign out, suddenly every Google search, you're signed in with your Google account. Very smart of them. And if you don't do that, they'll just use your IP address. So they are gathering what information they can. Now, whether they ultimately can pair that up with your identity rather than just a consistent creature that keeps visiting them with this IP address or this cookie, that's another question. You might have to give them your identity, or they'd have to do some serious spade work to discover it. For people as paranoid as you may be, there are anonymizing networks. There's both grassroots ones like Tor, pay ones like anonymizer.com. They all are slow. They all make things a pain in the butt so that you really have to be fearful before you find yourself using them. Best thing to do is probably just to piggyback on your neighbor's Wi-Fi.
But, I mean, if you can envisage a situation in which a different version of Google was to say, use our search engine, we'll give you mass adverts, but we won't record what you're looking at. I mean, for people like me, that would be quite popular. And you could think of a scenario 3, 4, 5 years down the line when people might want that kind of service.
You could even code, and in fact they are out there in some ways, a special search engine called Brugle that just you type in the search and it runs to Google behind the scenes as if you, runs the search, gets the answers, and runs back and gives them to you. It'd be a search proxy, which would actually achieve what you want. And there are some playful ones out there that like give you all Google results back in gangsta talk. And it's like, who had time to do that? Somebody that was, you know, done submitting Kittlers. So you could find one of those proxies, and that might be a way, at least for Google surfing, of doing what you want to do. Otherwise, I would visit anonymizer.com or look up Tor the Onion Router, or Router, which is a project of the Electronic Frontier Foundation for just these purposes.
You mentioned things like Facebook and the iPhone,
yes,
closing down sort of walled gardens,
yes,
that sort of strangle innovation in a way. But do you actually see such a threat to the web itself? Because, you know, if you go to Silicon Valley, that huge burst of creativity and a lot of idealism about openness and,
yes,
and freedom, and now the technology allows, you know, two guys with a lot of pizza sitting in a coffee shop or whatever to create the next YouTube or whatever website it is.
Yes.
And is there really actually a threat to that happening?
I do see that threat. Now, again, it's crystal ball. There's all sorts of contingencies that can happen between then and now to say how likely it is. But if we create a world where between the brain of the person you are trying to commune with and you, there is some slice in there where a gatekeeper can operate or be influenced by government to operate, those two guys eating pizza can't get it in front of them. I mean, that's the story of internet filtering. Internet filtering made even that much more easy when it's affected through the hardware device as well as through the network. And it may be that if you're wanting to make money, you can very rationally decide whether to code your platform for Facebook, code your news, knowing that Facebook reserves the right to take a cut. You say, well, I would otherwise do it, but I don't want to do that, and make your own, and maybe people can visit you there. Just like people could choose, and you would think the market would produce a search engine that promises not to track you if that turned out to be precious to a lot of people. But I'm concerned that people aren't even weighing that very much when they operate in the market. And the innovations I'm most excited about on the Facebook platform are not so much the carefully planned ones that do raise money and think about this rationally, but the just flash of craziness slash brilliance things that don't read the fine print might find themselves with the rest of the herd coding for a platform or an environment that can shut them down or moderate what they do very easily. And that's why I still am worried. And where some of my solutions are just to try to raise awareness, to try to get developers to be a little more pushy with the platform makers before they agree to code for the platform. I think the platform makers would respond to that pressure.
BlackBerry is involved in a standoff with the Indian government and yes. security agencies.
Yes.
And thus far, the government appears to have got nowhere because they've simply refused
yes.
to collude in the decrypting the information.
Yes.
I don't know if it's on account of commercial considerations or a principled yes. stand, but the government seems to have been checkmated.
Yes.
Because thousands of BlackBerries are out there and they can't really stop
yes.
them. What do you read into? How do you assess this?
So I think the commercial considerations and principle nicely dovetail, and intentions are additive, and that's a form of privacy that really people are concerned about. Just as I think when you heard the story of the GPS, I imagine it kind of gives you pause, and there's a reason why that company wanted to be anonymous in the case, so there wouldn't be a market response to the knowledge that it could do this. In that particular standoff, the most powerful argument back to the government from the company is, we'd love to, but we can't. Sorry, our platform doesn't allow that. And RIM has claimed this. The way we've architected the platform, it's designed to be bulletproof and not to let anybody in the middle surveil. Sorry. Now, if I'm advising the Indian government, not on principle, but they wrote me a check and they want my best technical advice, I think the right answer to that is, well, great. You can't do it now. Reprogram it so that you can. This isn't like a law of physics that prevents you from doing it. It's a choice about how to build your network. And we're telling you, if you want a network in India, you're going to build it this way. The government could push back, and then it would be up to RIM to see if they could get the public enough riled that the government has to lay off, or that they could say, we're out of here. You know, we just don't want we don't want to operate in your country under those circumstances. But as long as it's a company that wants to make money in a physical territory and needs to be in that territory to make it happen, as BlackBerry basically does, particularly because it's generally not using the internet per se to move messages into and out of the BlackBerry, the government holds a pretty high card against the company if it wants to do it. The government would be smart to try to play the card early before there's a whole embedded infrastructure, but we actually saw something similar with the patent case in the United States, where BlackBerry had a patent troll coming after them, and like they were about to get an order from a federal district court that says you must either pay them a huge pile of money or shut down every BlackBerry in the country, for which they had their programmers working day and night to find some workaround to amount to roughly the same service where it didn't infringe the patent. And that's the kind of project that the Indian government could, if it wanted, demand that RIM do. So I think we're out of time. I hope we stay in touch. Thank you so much. This has been fascinating. Thank you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.